Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Singing for Survival, the Kapwara History Podcast. Today's episode is going to be a complete departure from the previous format of this podcast. There will be no music, and we will not be talking about a specific person or a specific time period. Instead, we'll be talking about the pervasive problems of sexual harassment and abuse in Kapwara that recent news reports have once again highlighted. This is unfortunately not new news. Over the years, this topic has come up several times as movements like Me Too have encouraged people who were victimized to come forward. This is certainly not a subject I intended or even wanted to cover when I started this podcast, but it's something I feel like I have to talk about before continuing this work. As someone who is a teacher and a leader in the Kapwara community, at least locally, I feel like it would be irresponsible of me to just continue with this history project without saying anything about such a monumental event like this is. Now, I'm not an authority on this subject, but I've put considerable effort into educating myself about it. And I think that I am capable of sharing the details of what has happened and also some of the information on what we know about the state and realities of sexual harassment and abuse, at least here in my home country. Now, I have a few main goals for this episode. First is to relay the details of what we know has happened. Too many times, people, especially beginners or people who are newer to a group, get incomplete stories or information because people don't want to talk about these difficult topics, and in many cases because they don't get the same amount of respect as someone who is either higher rank or has been around a group for longer. I've certainly been on that end of things, receiving incomplete information, and it's really not a good feeling. And this makes those people feel excluded from the rest of the group, and it also makes it very difficult for them to make decisions on their future in Kapwara, and really even their involvement at all. So I want to start in a place where we can all have the same level of information on at least what we know has happened and where we are. Second is to educate on the realities of sexual harassment and abuse, at least here in the United States. I frequently notice when these conversations come up that there's a fundamental misunderstanding of how common these crimes are, how infrequently they're reported, and how rare false reports are. Now, this misunderstanding severely hampers discussion on these topics and really hurts our chances at progress, since we're often sidelined in dealing with all of these red herrings and just correcting incorrect or outdated information, and we never really get anywhere. Finally, I want to examine what aspects of Kapwara structures and cultures may be contributing to the perpetuation of these abuses and what we can do to improve those things. It's certainly true that these problems exist everywhere, across all different kinds of organizations, across all different continents, but there are structures, especially those of power, that can make them either more prevalent or easier to hide. Like I said, this is not a Kapwara problem, but this is a problem that Kapwara is having right now. And it would be a mistake to not take a very critical look at Kapwara itself to see if there are things that we need to either improve or change so that these abuses are less likely to happen at all, or they're more difficult for people to hide, so that we can stop them before they're perpetuated. And again, I don't claim to have all the answers here. I wish that I could have the end-all solution for this problem. I'm only taking a look at available research to suggest what we can try, what has been tried by other similar organizations, and what has worked in the past. In addition to all of that, these recent reports, as well as several other contributing factors over the past few years, have led to changes in my own Kapwa life. I have recently decided to separate from Kapwa Manjinga, and this is not just me, but also several other people that that I train with here in California. And in the sake of openness and honesty, I want to share with you my reasons why I'm doing this, what has led to this decision for me. So at the end of this episode, after I get through this material, I want to talk for a little bit about what has happened in our own group and what have led to what's led to my decision to separate and where I'm going in Kapwa now. So now, before we start, just strong trigger warning for anyone listening. In this episode, we'll be talking about sexual violence, abuse, and rape, in some cases involving minors. So let's start today's episode by talking about exactly what has happened. A report published on June 1st, 2021, detailed an ongoing investigation against the leaders of Cordao de Ouro for reports of sexual abuse and rape of students, including minors. This investigation is being carried out by the Public Ministry of the State of Ceará and involves statements by at least 15 people that detail accusations against several Maestres, some of who are named in the report, but others who remained unnamed in order to preserve the investigation. Maestri Suasuna, the leader of Cordao de Ouro, is one of the people implicated. I will link the article as well as an English language version of that article in the description, so you can read it for yourself, but I'll warn you, the details are very disturbing to read. To summarize, it appears that several CDO Maestris routinely sexually abuse students, many of whom were minors, and that victims' complaints were either ignored by others in the organization, or they were threatened with violence to keep quiet. The victims were vulnerable not only because of their age, but also due to their social statuses, and many were promised the chance to travel if they kept quiet. Victims who have tried to speak up in the past have often been pushed out of Kapwa, denied graduations or titles, and or received death threats to protect those committing abuse. The Maestris who have thus far been named in this investigation are Maestri Payacan, Maestri Espihu, Maestri Quebrinha, and Maestri Suasuna. Espihu has very recently also been exposed when a video surfaced of him just 2 years ago publicly masturbating on a bus. The person who recorded that video says he was being followed by Espihu on that bus and started recording in an effort to get him to stop. The release of this video has encouraged other people to come forward with their experiences and has at least partially led to the current investigation. The scope and impact of these revelations is really just staggering. Not only because of how big of names these people are in the Kapwa world, but also because of how systematized this appears to be. It seems that several people across the Cordao de Ouro leadership, at the very top levels of the leadership, were aware of some of these things happening and actively participated in either downplaying or excusing these things to help protect those abusers. It's hard not to draw parallels between this and the Catholic Church, in just the fact that these are minors being abused in many cases. These are very vulnerable people who are essentially, you know, Kupwit is a large part of their life, and the people committing the abuse are essentially in control of their progress in that. So that leverage was used against them in order to abuse them, in order to harm them. And it's really devastating to hear that something like this had been going on for so long, especially for someone who's been in Kupwit for a long time and who is it's a very important part of my life. It's hard to deal with these things when they happen. But like I said in the intro, this is sadly not entirely new news. I'd say the scope and gravity of this is certainly new, but the fact of sexual misconduct being a problem in Kupwit is something that we've known. And this is partially came to light because of the Me Too movement here in the United States, and a bit around a survey that was conducted a little more than 2 years ago that was led by Kupwitistas here in the Bay Area. So there was an online survey that was conducted to collect information from people in the Kupwit community about sexual misconduct that they witnessed or experienced. And these are just some highlights from that survey. So there were 908 respondents, 68% of whom were female, and 55% of all respondents were from the United States. So 93% of people who were in Kupwit for at least 10 years witnessed sexual misconduct, and 79% of all respondents, regardless of experience, witnessed misconduct. 69% of women experience unwanted sexual attention, and 12% of men experience unwanted sexual attention. Of those people who experienced that unwanted attention, 84% did not report it. And of those who did report, 73% were not satisfied with the process. Finally, 33% of respondents commented that there was abuse of rank. So it's clear that sexual misconduct is a problem in Kupwit. It's something that we've known about for a while, and it's something that these latest revelations with how really heinous they are and how widespread they seem to be are really calling attention to. So it's right now is a very important moment for us in the Kupwit community. It's an important time for us to pay attention to the things that are happening, to really take it all in and deal with how uncomfortable it is and how painful it is to experience these stories. And importantly, to try to better ourselves, better our community, and prevent these things from happening again. So now that we've laid out where the community stands right now, the things that have happened, I want to get into some of the basic facts around the state of sexual violence and abuse in our community. So I'm going to be talking specifically about the United States for this section, since that's where I live, that's what I know the most about, and that's where I have data from. Anyone who's paid attention to the news in the last decade or so has heard stories of widespread sexual abuse in some organization or another, or being conducted by some highlighted person. The Catholic Church is probably the biggest example, at least in my lifetime, but there's also Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, and Larry Nassar, just to name a few. These are all high-profile examples of people and organizations that perpetuated and hid abuse over many years, in some cases over decades. But how do these really high-profile and, you know, events that had a lot of media attention translate into the frequency of these crimes on more of the ground level, into like the everyday person and population? So according to the 2015 National Intimate Partner and Sexual Violence Survey conducted by the CDC Division of Violence Prevention. 43.6% of women experience some form of contact sexual violence in their lifetime. And here they're defining contact sexual violence as either rape, sexual coercion, or unwanted sexual contact. 21.3% of women experienced rape or attempted rape in their lifetime. 24.8% of men experienced some form of contact sexual violence. And 2.6% of men experienced rape or attempted rape in their lifetime. So just to give a little backing behind the study that I'm pulling from, this 2015 survey conducted 10,081 interviews, and there was another 2010 study in which 18,000 interviews were conducted that shows essentially the same results. Both of these studies are giving us the takeaway that nearly half of women and about a quarter of men experience some form of contact sexual violence in their lifetime. These numbers really only tell half of the story. Thinking back to some of the high-profile cases that I mentioned, these people and organizations were able to get away with their abuses for many, many years. So how were they able to get away with these for so long? Well, part of that is in how often these crimes are reported by the victims. According to a 2018 Department of Justice report, which surveyed 151,000 households covering nearly a quarter million people, 40% of rapes were reported to the police in 2017, and that number dropped to 25% in 2018. As a comparison to kind of ground our understanding of these numbers, the report rate for all violent crimes was about 50% for both of those years. So this naturally brings up the next question. If these crimes are so common, you know, covering nearly half of women and a quarter of men, why are these report rates so low? Lower even than violent crimes in general? Why are so many victims staying quiet? Now, there's a lot of material that we could go into on why people don't speak up, but I think it would be most helpful to look back at the survey done within the Capoeira community, since that exact question was asked. In that survey, people who had experienced some sort of sexual harassment, violence, or abuse were asked to list their reasons for not reporting. And in those reasons, 43% of respondents included, "I did not think anything would be done." 41% included that they felt uncomfortable making the report. 28% included that it was not important enough to report. And 25% included that they took care of the problem themselves. So the reason I want to really narrow in on the responses from this report is because they really tell us a lot about why victims don't report the things that happen to them. And the reasons that are listed here are reflective of what our currently available literature says. So it's a nice microcosm for us to really dig into this subject. So let's first start with a statement that that the person felt uncomfortable making the report. Very often, someone who is a victim of abuse was victimized by someone who has some level of power over them. Oftentimes, this is an employer, it can be someone they know, it can be a parent, but it all remains that there's some kind of power that person has over them, or there's some control that they have over certain aspects of their life. So immediately, there's the thought of the consequences that a person who has that level of power or control could enact on the victim. If we look at the Capoeira community, there's a very strict hierarchy in terms of in terms of our ranking, in terms of the respect that brings, and the what happens in the students' Caputa life, whether they receive ranks, whether they receive titles, whether they're allowed to teach, whether they're allowed to travel. All of these things are leverage that someone with higher rank or power can have over someone, and that can have a chilling effect on their willingness to call someone out or to report someone. In addition to that, people often fear that others won't follow them when they speak up or won't stand behind them, leaving them stranded. This is inextricably tied to the previous point, where if someone has a lot more power than someone else, then their word carries a lot more weight. And in a lot of our current discussions, a lot of the recent culture, at least in the US, there's a lot of scrutiny that's brought on victims when they report. And if they are bringing allegations against someone with more power, there's a lot of fear that their word won't be taken as seriously. And the second thing that we can get into with these reasons that were listed kind of encapsulates all of the other three statements together. So those other three were, didn't think anything would be done, wasn't important enough to report, or they took care of it themselves. So what those three say to me is that the people who experienced these things did not have faith in their group or their community that their experiences would be taken seriously and that there was a process to deal with them. So companies have HR departments to deal with interpersonal issues, and that they directly deal with issues of sexual harassment and abuse of power. Caputa community doesn't have that. A lot of times our groups are just being run by a handful of people, and we don't really have the robust structures in order to allow for safe reporting that's, you know, transparent and trustworthy to the people. So if people don't trust that system, then they just won't say anything because they fear the consequences that are going to come to them due to that power imbalance. Now, this I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself because this is going to get a little into the things within systems, especially Caputa, that can make these situations worse. But I just want to kind of briefly put that out there, that many people who experience harassment, abuse, violence, rape, don't say anything. And they, not to authorities, and a lot of times not even to the people that they trust and know. And there are really strong reasons behind why that's happening. It's not for no reason. And it's even more of a serious problem than just generally not reporting crimes. This is something that's very specifically underreported. So now that we've talked about the prevalence of harassment, violence, and abuse in our community, the problems of underreporting, I want to move on to the next topic, which often comes up, which is that of false accusations. I've seen many times conversations get derailed by people talking about how prevalent false accusations are and how many men have their lives ruined by those lies. I want to say first off that if someone truly accuses someone else falsely of sexual violence or rape, they should be punished. It's not excusable to lie to bring legal action against another person, and it's definitely a problem when that happens. But that being said, how common are false accusations really? Multiple studies, including a meta-analysis of more than 20 previous studies, put false reports of rape and sexual assault between 2 and 10%. This is an incredibly low number when compared to the percentage of sexual assaults and rapes that go unreported. So clearly they do not represent the larger problem for this issue. So if that's the case, why is the narrative of an epidemic of false rape accusations so common when people try to talk about pervasive issues of sexual violence? Well, I dug into this a little bit, and it comes down to some previous and now outdated research. So some previous studies vastly overestimated the prevalence of false reports. This includes an often cited 2004 study that put the rate at 41%, and even a 1981 study that claimed 90% of reports were false. However, these studies either drew sweeping generalizations from very small sample sizes, in some cases less than 20, or considered cases that could not be proven to legal standards as false. This is obviously going to inflate the number of quote-unquote false accusations, since it's often difficult to provide hard physical evidence of things that have happened, especially things that happened in the past. More recent analyses have determined the inadequacies of these studies and have converged on the 2 to 10% range. So what a lot of the discourse on false accusations comes down to then is people operating off of outdated or bad information that had inflated these numbers. Now, I know that statistics can be really hard to internalize on a physical day-to-day level, even for people who have been trained in statistics. So I think it's helpful to walk through a hypothetical example just to get a real grasp on what these numbers really mean. So let's imagine an average town that is representative of average trends when it comes to crime across the United States. And let's say in that town, 1 year there are 100 reports of sexual assault. According to our previous stats, 2 to 10% of those reports will be false, meaning that, at a minimum, 90 of those reports are legitimate. If we then factor in the number of assaults that are actually reported, that would mean between 225 and 360 assaults occurred that year in that town. So to package these together, in this town, in that 1 year, we would have had up to 360 assaults actually occur and 2 to 10 false reports being issued. And again, to go back, I think that giving a false report of a sexual assault is terrible and should be punished, but it is clearly not the bigger problem here. And derailing the conversation to focus on them is really not a productive use of our time. Now that we've spent some time digging into the basics and the facts around sexual harassment and abuse in the United States, I want to delve deeper into how this relates to organizations that are similar to Capoeira. Like I said in the intro, these problems are not unique to Capoeira, but I think it would be a mistake to not take a very critical look at the cultures and structures within the art to see if there are things that enable abuse. From the reading I've done, it seems there are three major things that can make an organization more prone to sexual harassment and abuse. And those are it being male-dominated, strongly hierarchical, and having a lack of accountability or consequences for bad behavior. So let's walk through these one by one. For the first part, being male-dominated. And for this point, I am not saying that abuse is an inherently male thing. I'm not saying that women can't be abusers or even enable abuse themselves. That absolutely happens, and abuse is not something that is intrinsically male. But studies have shown that men in these male-dominated organizations have a harder time recognizing when women are being treated in a sexist way. In addition, male-dominated groups tend to be more permissive of what we often call locker room culture, or essentially toxically masculine behavior that can easily lead to minimizing harassment. So I'm not giving an essentialist argument here about abuse being committed by men. I'm rather saying that the male cultures that develop in these types of organizations can oftentimes ignore or be permissive of harassment because of either that kind of locker room culture or just because men have a harder time recognizing when women are being treated in that way. Second, strong hierarchies can also make these problems worse. And I'm not saying that all hierarchies encourage abuse, since almost every organization has some degree of hierarchy to help them operate, but it's the degree of power imbalance between the steps in those systems. The more power a person has, the more they feel they can do what they want without considering the feelings of those with less power. In addition, as we've seen with reasons why people stay silent, people with little power will often feel voiceless or that nothing will be done about the problems that they bring up. An example of this outside of Capoeira is in Harvey Weinstein, who used the power that he had over people's careers to perpetuate abuse for decades. Like we talked about before, if you feel like someone has control over your career or power over that kind of economic part of your life, you're much less likely to want to speak up. And finally, is a lack of accountability and consequences. When people feel that it is either risky for them to report harassment or abuse, or they think nothing will be done about it when they do report, that seriously discourages them from saying anything at all. Like we said before, this contributes to why so many abuses are not reported. If less people are willing to report abuses, then those perpetrators can continue committing abuses without fear of consequence. There are several examples in recent U.S. history that we can all call to see how this has played out. Uber repeatedly protected top performers from harassment complaints, which led to a mass exodus of women engineers from the company. News entertainment personalities like Bill O'Reilly and Matt Lauer kept their powerful positions and insane salaries even after several allegations of harassment and/or assault. Seeing these things happen, seeing people get away with abuse, away with harassment, really makes people lose faith in the systems that they're a part of. That's why we saw so many people, or particularly women, leave Uber when they showed that they were unwilling to bring consequences against their top performers because they were top performers. So I gave some examples of outside of Capoeira, but how do these three categories relate to the Capoeira community, the Capoeira structure, the typical structure of our groups? And it's clear that, I mean, we check essentially all three of the boxes. Capoeira is, at least traditionally, very male-dominated. Of course, this varies a lot across the United States in different groups, but still, the leadership among Capoeira, the most influential maestres, teachers, personalities, are predominantly male. And Capoeira certainly has a strong hierarchical structure. There is a whole lot of reverence that is given to people who've been in Capoeira for a long time, especially to maestres. And it's partially because of what the rank of maestre actually is. Being a maestre means you need to be recognized by the community. And that tends to elevate their status a whole lot more than other ranks do. Almost to like a non-person level, where you don't really see them as people. There's one example of this from my own life in Capoeira that I always come back to when I think about this subject. I was invited to a Capoeira workshop where there was a very famous maestri who was being invited. He had traveled just for this workshop, and we were all very excited to attend. I was relatively young in the art. And we all get there, we all get to the venue of the workshop, and the people who are organizing essentially gather us all together and tell us, all right, guys, when the Mestre shows up, we need you guys to really make sure to give him a whole lot of applause, you know, make sure you're shouting and be really, really enthusiastic, because if you don't, then he may leave. He may just walk out. And that experience really stuck with me because it seemed like, I mean, it was ridiculous to me at the time, but it was something that was just kind of came with the territory, so, you know, you kind of go along with it. But it's easy to see how that level of reverence is not healthy. I mean, how can you be told that about someone who's coming to visit and then expect to, you know, see them as a fellow person? So that kind of level of hierarchy certainly exists in Kapwara across lots of different groups. And it's something that can be extremely problematic. It's something that I think contributed a lot to the abuses that we saw in this recent report, especially to how long they were able to be perpetuated for. And then finally, we go back to the lack of accountability and consequences. So from the survey that was conducted back a few years ago, it's clear that people felt that there was a lack of accountability then. And people have felt this for some time. And it's also clear when we look at this report that there is a lack of accountability and consequences, since people were committing these offenses for many years, and some of the other people implicated were told about it. If you read the report, there are instances where some of the victims reported the things that happened to them to other leadership, to other masteries, and they were either ignored or just given some lip service, or in some cases even threatened to keep quiet. So this lack of accountability and consequences is certainly going to degrade people's confidence in the current structures we have in Kapwara. And it's really indicative to me that there are serious problems that we have to address. So now, given all of this information, the big question for all of us in the Kapwara community is now, what do we do about this? What changes do we make to prevent these things from happening again, or to dealing with them if they ever do? To try to start to answer this, I want to get into some recent work that was done by the U.S. military. The military performed a review and study on harassment and abuse within their ranks in 2014, as waves of allegations of widespread abuse were breaking. The military is also a male-dominated, strongly hierarchical organization, so in many respects can be prone to similar problems as Kapwara. This review posited the following things that would be effective in reducing incidents of harassment. 1. Clearly, widely distributed policies on harassment. 2. Regular education. 3. Formal and informal reporting, investigation, and remediation procedures. And 4. Regular self-assessments. Much of this comes down to educating people about harassment, consent, and power dynamics, and then creating robust structures to protect victims and also give a clear path for action that ensures the victim's complaints and or allegations are taken seriously and dealt with. This not only makes it clear to would-be abusers that there's no tolerance for that behavior, but also facilitates an environment where people are more comfortable to come forward, since they can be confident that they will be taken seriously and protected. This gets at many of the reasons why people don't report offenses that happen to them. And if we can encourage that reporting to happen more, it's more likely that we have the opportunity to intervene. And then if we couple that with a clear procedure to both investigate and remediate offenses when they happen, then we can cut off these things early before we let, you know, these widespread abuses happen for years and years. We want to intervene as soon as possible so we can take corrective action. In relating these kind of changes to the Capoeira world, it's important to point out that some groups are already implementing changes similar to this. In the time since the report broke, Capoeira Batuque has announced that they are taking the following actions. One, requiring background checks and live scan registration for all teachers. Two, providing training for teachers and staff on how to recognize, disrupt, and report sexual misconduct. Three, implementing a committee for handling grievances. Four, providing parents with resources for discussing safety issues with children. And five, committing to not invite or financially support offending mestres. These are all great steps in helping make their Capoeira group more resilient to these kind of offenses and to help their students feel more safe and give them confidence that if something happens, there's a procedure to help them deal with that. My opinion is that these issues cannot just be solved at the group level, primarily because groups are always visiting and interacting with each other at events, hodas, visiting classes, and it's important that we all have the same standards community-wide. I want to know that when I bring my students to visit another group, that group has the same systems in place to keep them safe. In addition, our community at large has lots of really great and talented people with really varied skill sets that can benefit the community across all of the different groups. We don't have to all be by ourselves trying to figure this out. The more we cooperate, the better we can all do together. I think that the steps taken by groups like Capoeira Batuque are fantastic. I really respect what they're doing and am inspired by it myself. And I think that some of the conversations that are happening community-wide here in the Bay Area are also really encouraging to me, because I think this community cooperation is something that's absolutely critical for us to make the changes that we need in order to correct for the features of the Capoeira community and the group structure that are not conducive to safety. I think sometimes in the past, and probably more in the more recent past, we've gotten into a really divided group mentality, a really separate, almost like old school martial arts group mentality, where we all are separate, we're all doing our own things, and we don't really share a lot of information with each other, almost in a really like competitive way. And I think that is in itself another way that that abuses can get perpetuated, because all of the information gets contained within a certain group. You know, no group wants to let that information get out and embarrass themselves or harm the ego of the group itself. So it stays really compartmentalized. And when things stay compartmentalized like that, it's much easier for people to perpetuate abuses. So I'm here to cooperate and collaborate with the community. And I really look forward to seeing what we can do in order to make Capoeira a safer and more resilient place. So I guess now this brings us to what changes these recent events have brought to me personally in Capoeira. I'll say that this was definitely a very challenging time. It was very hard hearing a lot of these allegations against the people that were listed in this report, partially because some of them, like Messi Quebrinha, are people that I know and have had interacted with in the past, and some people were people very important to my own path in Capoeira, people who inspired me, people who I looked up to and respected. And it's really hard to find out these things about people that you have that kind of respect for. But in the aftermath of these allegations, I, along with other people that were formerly a part of the Oakland branch, have chosen to separate from Capoeira Mandinga and from Mestre Marcelo. And there are a few reasons for this. And a lot of it comes back to allegations that are public that happened about 2 years ago. So 2 years ago, it was revealed that Mestre Marcelo had an inappropriate relationship with a student who was a minor at the time. And this relationship had happened back sometime in the early 2000s. And when I say it like this, I'm not trying to downplay or sugarcoat this. This was sexual abuse. This was child abuse. But I don't know how old the student was. I've heard many conflicting things from people in the community, from people in our group, from Mr. Marcelo himself. And so suffice to say, the student was a minor. And at that time, there were several members of the group who immediately chose to leave because of this. There were others who tried to find some sort of reconciliation with Mestre Marcelo, and due to that being unsuccessful, left. And then there were those of us, like myself, who chose to stay at the time. In order to try to find some sort of reconciliation to keep the group together and to rebuild Capoeira Mandinga in a way that was going to keep or hold Mestre Marcelo accountable, but move forward still under the Mandinga banner. There were changes that we were successful in making, and there were changes that we were not successful in making. And part of the reason why I'm choosing to leave is the fact that I don't feel that this was properly dealt with. I don't think that he was properly held accountable. And I don't think that the changes that we wanted to make, like changing the business structure of the group into a more cooperative model to level out some of the power dynamics, were successful. Second is that he has chosen to respond to these recent allegations in this report in a way that seeks to protect those who are accused, downplay the alleged crimes, and discredit the victims. And this is, in and of itself, this is entirely unacceptable to me. But it is also the way that he had initially responded to the stories that came out back 2 years ago. And to me, it indicates that he is not, that we have not really made progress. That the things that we had tried to do back 2 years ago were not really successful. And it made me lose confidence in his leadership. And there's a lot of little things that I could say, but I think those are the two major points that they interplay with each other a lot. And what it all comes down to is, with these recent revelations in these reports, coupled with what we have known has happened in the past, it is very clear that Capoeira has to change in order to move forward. We cannot keep doing what we're doing and expect to keep our students safe. And that's going to require our leadership to adapt. and change and really think critically about the things that we're doing. And because of his past actions and because of the way that he has dealt with those and the way that he has dealt with these most recent allegations, I don't have confidence in Mestre Marcelo's leadership going forward. And that is why I took the step to separate from the group. Now, if anybody has any additional questions for me about my reasons, you're more than welcome to send me a message. I'm more than happy to talk about it. In addition, if anyone has other questions about other things that I went into in this episode or have any issues with the things that I talk about, my email is always open. I'll include it in the description. Please feel free to send me a message. I'm always happy to talk about that and try to improve my own approaches more. But with all of that, I want to wrap up this episode with a quote from Father Donald Cousins, who was someone who wrote extensively about the problematic culture of the Catholic Church during the time when stories of widespread abuse within the church were revealed. He wrote, quote, "We are witnessing the collapse of the Roman Catholic Empire, not, I hope, of the Roman Catholic Church. Empires, whether temporal or ecclesial, no longer work." End quote. I think this quote is very timely, and I think it reflects a lot of what my personal feelings are about the Caputa community and about this situation. I dearly hope that these will lead to us changing Capoeira for the better, changing our group structures for the better, and that it doesn't cause us to lose Capoeira altogether.